They talked about it at AFN last year, and it did nothing but get worse. The rural-urban divide is back. There is out-migration from rural communities and complaints of unresponsiveness by government. Who should be doing what? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. It's time for some creativity in communicating between cultures. So where do we start? The phone lines are open at 1-800-478-8255 and Anchorage a local call 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org. What gets the message through from the bush is the topic on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
One of the privileges of living through a few decades in Alaska is that you acquire some interesting friends who, over time, become old friends. If you do talk radio, you have your old friends to help guide you. So it was my old friend, the writer Richard Leo, who called Alaska the final resting place of manifest destiny, which is kind of the same thing as the last frontier, but it explains it a little better. This push of a European culture across the continent, ignoring those who were already there, wasting the environment because there was always new land to the west, until there wasn't. And it also makes clear that push is over, and this place, Alaska, is the last chance to bring manifest destiny to a just conclusion, environmentally and in terms of coexistence between the cultures that are now mixed together here. With that in mind, I was primed to take notice when another old friend, who is now sitting across from me in this studio, called me up and said there was a crisis in rural Alaska and it was time to do a talk show about why not enough is being done about it. So here we are. I guess in some ways today's show extends the theme of examining what 50 years of statehood means. We've done some fascinating radio on that history, the past, but what about the next 50 years? A while ago, I was asked to make some predictions about the next 50 years of statehood. I predicted the permanent fund would still be there, but would be capped. That Alaska's coldness would become an economic asset on a warming planet. And that Alaskans would become leaders in bioneering as we all learn to work together towards sustainability. And I said Alaska would become a frontier of multiculturalism, people communicating across cultural boundaries. This is already happening, and we've discussed this on this program from time to time. The demographic forces at play in Alaska will make our population more and more diverse. It makes sense that we learn how to communicate between our cultures. It's something that's not easy. It's something that takes a lot of time. It's something that, as Jack Abraham and I were just discussing, you can think you're communicating, and actually you're not really getting through at all. Jack Abraham, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much for having me here. It's an honor and a great pleasure.
Jack and I go back a number of years. We were both artists in residence at the Visual Arts Center when that existed in downtown Anchorage. Jack hails from Nightmute. He's one of the best known native carvers, I think, in the state of Alaska, specializing in masks. And I understand you've given that up now.
Oh, yeah. I think after 20 years, it's time for a change. I think I'm going to focus on my music primarily, but also dealing with particular issues that concern all Alaskans, not just Native Alaskans. But like you said, I called because I got involved with a group to work as a lobbyist for a particular issue coming up in October 3rd called the Clean Energy and Securities Act, and I was doing my best to try to get focus on Native people to try to understand what the issue is about because it very much concerns their life out there, seeing that they're paying such high prices for fuel, for instance, and what I experienced and a little interesting enough, even though that I am Yupik myself. Trying to get the message across to some people. They seem to get the message to some degree, but are what I noticed Time and time again, there are people are like maybe unable to articulate what they're trying to say sometimes, or maybe they don't completely understand the issues. What I notice about a lot of people, they're aren't really involved in politics to begin with anyway, don't understand. They usually kind of leave things up to other people. But what I was trying to get across to some people that things are changing so fast now, especially the environment. And we can't always depend on the politicians or other people to do things for us, because after what I read last year about that fellow from Amana having to decide between keeping his house, farming, and feeding his family, I think, you know, it's about time for me to get involved in something like this. So what I experienced was that people do feel and they understand to some degree, but are not, don't have perhaps the tools or the method, or not sure of how to go about how to get involved. So I think that's probably the challenge that I'm going to be facing in the next month or so.
Yeah, you know, one thing, anecdote that caught me that you told was, my job was to produce phone calls, to get people to call from rural Alaska, Alaska Native people to call and press for the Senate to pass the Energy Security Act. But guess what? They wouldn't call. They wouldn't call. And you could, there's a cultural issue there.
Yeah, I think they're just basically, you know, lack of a better term, a lot of Native people are just very shy, or are not used to being outspoken Well, I'm very outspoken. I've always been that way. That's just my nature. So
we've noticed.
But I think, though, I realize, though, even as difficult as it is, I cannot just walk away from this, and because I would just be another person that's given up and part of the problem.
Yeah, and you know, from my, on the other side of the cultural divide, the way I look at it is, I'm thinking, well, maybe they don't want to call up and talk about nothing. You know what I mean? And just talk about something that's abstract and political. If it was something concrete and direct, they might really want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there's the way things are framed up. I want to go to a second guest at this point, Jack.
Okay.
The telephone number here is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And the email is talk@APRN.org. That might come in handy. We really hoped to have a Yupik translator on, but that has not come through because they're all busy. They're all busy and paying work. We can't pay, which makes sense. But it would be good to get people actually speaking in their native language on a show of this nature. We probably would all learn something if we get a little translating service. But we, despite our best efforts, I think we just didn't start early enough to really get somebody booked to do that. I'm sure it was doable. At this point, I'd like to call in our other guest. I think he's on his brand new BlackBerry cell phone, and I don't know if he knows exactly how it works, but at least it seems to be working in Bethel. Joe Sarcone, are you with us?
I am, and I'm on a payphone in the Hagland Aviation Terminal waiting for a plane out to Tununik, which is actually on weather hold at the moment, which is something that anybody that's traveled in rural Alaska understands.
You know? Totally, totally. Well, Joe, I'll introduce you briefly as the former head of rural sanitation at the EPA Region 10 office, or at least the Region 10 office in Anchorage, and also that you have moved on now to a job with the Center for Disease Control, right?
Mm-hmm, that's true.
But I think a lot of people, and Native people included, know you as the honey bucket guy from the federal government. And I'm here to help you.
Yes, that's true.
And I've asked you to participate on this program, and so glad that you could, because and I know that you probably run out of quarters there pretty quick, but but you're the thing is that you have written several papers for professional journals where you're basically going into this very matter that Jack and I are trying to get a discussion kicked off about, which is communicating across cultural boundaries. And sometimes you don't, you know, you're writing from the government point of view, and your point is that sometimes you don't know whether you've communicated or not, and you only find out the hard way later on. And you had a great anecdote in your latest paper with regards to the refugees in Africa that you had worked with in the Peace Corps. I thought maybe it'd be good if you would retell that. The one about, the ordering the shovels.
Well, thanks, Steve, for giving me the opportunity to be on the call. I had been working in a refugee program during the civil war in Mozambique, and the importance of construction of latrines for improved sanitation was something that everyone understood, because the refugees used latrines in their home villages. So when we were organizing the campaign, we started off with the question of, or the assertion that, well, first we need to dig holes. And everyone was, yes, you know, we have to dig holes. And then I said, okay, then we'll need to have shovels. And there wasn't the same response. There was no, you know, enthusiastic response. But I figured, well, I knew that in order to dig holes, we needed shovels, you know. That was my worldview. And so I went off and bought the tools and the shovels and came back to the camp and dropped them off with materials and went on to the next camp. And when I came back to the first camp a week later, there weren't any latrines built. And I was wondering what had happened, because we had agreement that latrines were the step to take to improve sanitation. We talked about digging holes, and I thought that with these materials there should be latrines, but there weren't. So I asked around, and finally one of the refugees, sanitation workers, came up and gently informed me that, in fact, you know, the people didn't dig with shovels. They used the hoe blades attached to the wood sticks, or the wood that was gathered from around the bush, to tie the hoe blades with bush twine to the stick, and they dug with those blades. And so when I went out and bought those blades locally and brought them back, then there were latrines built all over the place. But not only were the latrines built then, but the cost of building them was much less, because the shovels were imported and it cost a lot of money for the program. And so I just wanted to sort of connect that around to rural Alaska. And for many of people who been around rural Alaska for a while, know Father Alexa. And, you know, he's a speaker, and he writes on cross-cultural issues widely. And he has said that communication across cultures is approximate and imperfect. But where there is a miscommunication, it is always the non-dominant culture that suffers the consequence. And, in fact, this is what happened in this situation, and happens so often, you know, that those latrines weren't being built because of that miscommunication, but I wasn't the one that was suffering the consequence. It was the people, the refugees, that were. And we see this all the time in rural Alaska.
Yeah. It strikes me, they were probably barefoot. It's hard to use a shovel when you're barefoot.
It wasn't my best moment, Steve.
No, Joe, but, it says something about you that you're willing to be humble enough to share this for the learning of it. And there's a lot of different angles for approaching and learning from this story, I think. And
I think we give people shovels more often than not. And I think that is the message of the story for all government employees. You know, we need to listen, so that we're not giving people shovels, we're giving them the tools that they need. And I think that's what Jack's saying too.
I think he's nodding and saying, go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, that is exactly pretty much what I'm saying. We need to find, like you said, creative ways to communicate better. And I think listening more to what the people who are most affected by these problems have to say. And one of the suggestions I wanted to make to the secretaries that are supposed to be coming back up here to study the problems of rural areas, I said, well, I think maybe you should just live out there for a while on a limited income, then you'd really get some real perspective on how difficult things are. But on the other side of this issue, we're talking about how the subdominant culture suffers the most, and that isn't very much the case here. And I think part of the problem that needs to happen here is that the people out in the villages, whoever might be listening, hopefully they can pass on a message to other people in the village in their particular language if they have to, and really try to encourage people to get involved in the process of political progress. Do yourself to educate yourself as much as you can about these kind of issues that are going on. And don't stand by and wait for other people to make decisions for us. It's really important now that more than ever, because out there they're paying the $8 a gallon in some places for heating fuel. So that's a wake-up call in itself there.
Joe, in another of your papers, you go into this idea of how to listen. And I thought maybe you would want to talk about that a little bit.
Well, certainly, when we look at the programs that government delivers to, especially underserved populations and indigenous populations, you know, we're a lot of times constrained by the way that our programs are structured, you know, by the laws that we have to follow and the regulations we enforce and the policies that we have, and all too often we are constrained by those in the way that we actually communicate to our services to the people who we're trying to serve. In which case, we put ourselves in a box. And it's difficult to, we speak our language, the culture and language of our agencies, and we're all too often not able to communicate well with the people who we're trying to serve. And here's an example. Get into a situation where how can I say this? The most important thing to us is to, you know, meet our regulations. Yet, oftentimes we don't capture the need of people in the village because the. I'm sorry, I'm having to.
I can tell you're being a little distracted there. Let me help you through this one here, Joe, because you're the honey bucket, the guy from the government, and you're here to help us. And what you discovered was that there's kind of an obsession with flush toilets, and meanwhile nobody wants to talk about how to properly handle the honey buckets. That there are certain sanitation improvements that are rather obvious and inexpensive and so forth, and simply are never talked about.
Well, and here's the example. The Safe Drinking Water Act, if I can throw that out as a piece of legislation, was written to protect the nation's public water systems. But in fact, in Alaska, we have a lot of communities where people pack water and store water in their homes where there's no piped water and sewer. There isn't anything in the Safe Drinking Water Act that captures or includes improving the sanitation conditions of people who have no piped water and sewer. They're not captured under this law. And so even though they're captured by our mission, which is to protect human health and the environment, we're restricted or constrained by the actual rules that we work under. Now, what happens there is that there's unintended and very costly consequences to not addressing that issue of basic sanitation. And you can look at hospitalization rates for infectious disease. that are related to the lack of adequate water supply. And you can see that, you know, I think that we're hearing is up to a third of the hospitalization rates in areas in western Alaska are due to infectious disease related to the inadequate water quantity. And so, you know, we can...
And so here we got a, problem that's staring us straight in the face, and we can't even see it.
And it's, you know, there's a lot of resources to address and enforce the Safe Drinking Water Act, but the Safe Drinking Water Act doesn't capture the problem.
I gotcha. Yeah. Thank you. I want to get to some calls here, and Joe Sarcone is with us. He is formerly of the EPA's Rural Sanitation Office. Jack Abraham, an Alaskan artist, and I think we're seeing something really interesting here. We're seeing basically... from you, Joe, that we need that it's the bureaucrats actually need to be more creative too, or find the latitude or have some maneuvering room to do what seems what is obvious that needs to be done, as opposed to being constrained by the guidelines of their statutes and so forth sometimes. Mm-hmm. That they need to have some flexibility and adaptability. And then we're hearing from Jack that, you don't necessarily want to go to your spokesman when you're a native person and have them do all the talking for you, that maybe you've got to grab a hold of things from time to time and have some initiative and go into the civic and political arena, even though that really maybe doesn't quite line up with the cultural background of a person. Let's go to David, who joins the program from Galkona. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, David.
Good morning. Hey, I just listening to the radio station right now. In light of this water and sanitation and all that, the bureaucrats are messing around with the native people because, for one, federal state law states that you must go so many feet below when they're building housings. And the thing is, in Galkona, we're having problems with our water, even sewer, because our water level is pretty high, not to what the federal government requires you to drill so many feet. And the thing is, I think the most I can say is, what do we do with the problem, and what can we do to let the federal government HUD housing not to drill so far down? I think it was 60 feet in Galkona.
All right.
But then, yeah.
Thanks, David.
60 feet down. Yeah. You hit artesian well, and that's no good.
All right. I think there's probably a million examples like that. I appreciate you bringing that one up to us, David. Thanks for your call from Galkona. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about creativity crossing cultural boundaries. If we've got work to do as a people, as a culture, as a state, we got problems we want to solve. Are we even getting through to one another? And do we think we're getting through when we're not? And where are some of the hurdles that we can get a look at and say, well, if we just step back from this and listen a little better or speak up at certain times, things might work out a little better. We have Joe Sarcone, of the formerly of the Rural Sanitation Office of EPA Region 10, Jack Abraham, an Alaska artist from Nightmute, lives in Anchorage, well known to a number of people. And we're taking your telephone calls. I want to throw yet another example into the mix at this point, and that is the affair of the Yukon River flooding this year. I'm sure we'll get back to talking about the Yukon River because the people in a number of Yukon River communities are having a lot of problems. Jack alluded to it earlier when he talked about somebody in Ammonic having to decide about whether to go out hunting and use the fuel that way or use the fuel to keep his home warm. And when people are having those difficult sorts of decisions, where are the bureaucrats? If there is an emergency, who do you call? And in this case, Ed Megert was the guy in charge of the response to the flooding in the Yukon River communities, especially upriver, Eagle, Stevens Village, and like that. And this was a huge flood that suddenly happened, and he is a long-term employee of the Department of Environmental Conservation. When he got done with this thing, he quit. He threw in the towel. He said, I just cannot work with this balky bureaucracy. And APRN's Lori Townsend asked him to go into it. He said, well, there was one guy that wouldn't let me spend the money. He thought his job was bean counting. And we have an emergency here, and I have to have the money to respond to this, and I don't have enough people. He said, but that wasn't all.
Well, there's a problem with the structure of DEC. We're organized as pretty much as a stovepipe, and each program is separate. Now, we supposedly can reach over and get other people, but those people are not trained. We can use them for certain things, but not for others. And what I needed was trained personnel in this case. And we do have some of those in state, but they didn't come. The program manager sent out a directive to the other regions. Of course, Southeast is so understaffed right now with vacancies that they really couldn't spare anybody. They only have two. He sent out a directive to send people, and nobody came.
And you said you had two or three people working with you. How many should you have had?
A full complement would have been about 10 people at any one time. We should have been able to shift those out at about two-week intervals.
What do you think would have been different had you had the staff that you needed and the money would have been available when it should have been to you to do your job?
Well, the difference would have been pretty obvious. First of all, we would have had each person performing the function that they were trained to do. There were some mistakes made. I made some mistakes that I don't think I would have made had I been not busy trying to do things like contracting and making reservations and things like that. I should have been able to look at this. This was a unique situation. We've never dealt with ice like this before. And had I had the time to do that, I would have done some things differently. And also, I would not have had to send individuals into some of these areas, you know, by themselves. I would have been able to send teams in there, which was a proper way to do it.
Give us an example of what some of the things that happened that were troubling to you.
Well, for one, village of Old Eagle had asked for a 24-hour presence of the state troopers because they were having some problems. They had at least one person out there who was schizophrenic and was off their meds and drinking, and the state troopers weren't able to give them a 24-hour presence. They could send someone in there once a day or so, that sort of thing. Yet my guys had to be in there.
When you look at this overall situation with staffing shortages, is it something you think that the commissioner doesn't understand, or is it the role of the governor or the legislature? Where's the problem with getting this taken care of?
Well, what they would say was, well, if the legislature would give us more money, then we could put more positions out there. Well, quite frankly, at this point, we don't need more money. We just need to move some of the vacancies from where they are to where they need to be.
And that's Ed Megert, formerly the on-scene coordinator for the Department of Environmental Conservation's response to the flooding this spring in Eagle. It is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about creativity, crossing cultural boundaries. When we got problems, who you're going to call and how you're going to get through and who needs to listen and who needs to find more effective ways to communicate as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Pace Correspondence School offers the education you desire for your child. They have state allotment for students not currently enrolled in a public school, K-12 curriculum, and supportive certified teachers. Pace now offers services for dyslexia, including assessment and tutoring through the STRIVE program. Enrollment information available at 866-864-5491 and paceschool.net. This message sponsored by the Craig City School District.
In some communities in rural Alaska, problems are piling up. And it's not a question of, who's going to respond. It's a question of when. The problems are not going to go away. And as they pile up, it's just a question of how bad does the pressure become before something gets done, whether it's a catastrophe or whether somebody can come in there earlier and intervene. Somebody can be creative and say, well, here's what we need to do. Somebody can listen. And that's the kind of things we're trying to talk about today on Talk of Alaska. We're talking about pulling together as the people of the state of Alaska and doing what needs to be done. We've got Jack Abraham of Night Mute, an Alaska artist, in the APRN studios. We have Joe Sarcone, formerly of the EPA's Rural Sanitation Office, now with the CDC. They're both well known to many of our fellow Alaskans, and we're just trying to push our way through this communication barrier across cultures from both directions, and a bunch of calls are coming in as well. Joe, when you listened to that conversation with Ed Megert, it probably sounded all too familiar to you.
Oh, yes. I think that all too often we're asked to respond to situations, as I said before, that fall within that gray area between the body of law, regulation, policy, and the way that we do work on a day-to-day basis, and the need that's out there to protect human health and the environment, to provide public safety, to provide public education, primary health care, all these various services. And, we find ourselves in a place where there's uncontrolled burning, open dump sites, honey buckets, high rates of various infectious disease. And these are the types of things that present the types of challenges that Ed was talking about. And they're our reality. I mean, from a field, environmental public health or emergency response, that's the reality that we work in. And our organizations aren't flexible enough to and creative enough to address those issues oftentimes.
Well, we've seen sometimes what will happen is things will get so bad for Alaska Natives that the federal government will intervene. That was suggested should happen and might still happen with sexual assault. And it obviously has happened with subsistence. And now we see a bunch of, I think it's not necessarily a good sign, that you see a bunch of cabinet members of the Obama administration going directly to rural Alaska to see the situation there. We could see more pleas to the federal government to step in on behalf of Alaska Natives, and I'm not making this up. There's already pressure to have an Alaska Native seat on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Think about how many votes there are that might be able to put something that like that through Congress, and what that could mean for fisheries allocation. My point is things can get to where hardball gets played, and it'd be better, really, if we could solve things on our own instead of making it even more distance. But it's not always easy to accomplish that. We have to learn to get across some of these cross-cultural barriers. Let's go to another call in Seward. This is Tracy. Tracy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you so much. Well, how are you doing today?
Oh, just great. Very challenging kind of show to do.
It very much is. I have to say, I'm a homeschooling mother of four. My oldest daughter is 17 and a half years old. She's dating a young man who's Native Alaskan who's 17. And he's, as the elder that you have on the show today pointed out earlier, many of the Alaskan Natives are shy and don't necessarily want to get out there and speak their piece like he does. And they're very much about, you know, that's in their nature and you know, what's in your nature, and very forgiving and such. But what I'm seeing is this young man was raised white. He knows very little of his native languages. He knows very little of native politics, other than what he's been introduced to over the last year or so of being around us. He wasn't really introduced to that, wasn't interested, and didn't know anything about it. If you want to change Alaskan politics, you've got to start with the young people who are getting into it right now.
Woodjack's nodding his head.
Yeah, I've said that before many times myself, but I think that not only just focus on the young people, we need to also try to change some of the ways that people think that are old enough now to vote and get them to participate, because their lives, you know, their opinions are just as important. But you're right. You know, I think I will probably do some work to try to get young people involved in the political process.
Well, I think that your influence would be really good, because most of what I'm seeing in Alaska's political process, even for the Native Alaskans, as was pointed out earlier, is that most of them are white. Even here in Seward, one of the reasons that this young man doesn't want to go to the local tribal office is because really there's some information and stuff, but he doesn't feel comfortable, and it's mostly ran white. He just doesn't feel comfortable there.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there was a point, of course, with the Manifest Destiny and so forth, that genocide was pretty much a policy. It wasn't called genocide, but when you take kids out of their traditional background and put them into a boarding school with a bunch of people from other tribes, you know, and basically wash their mouths out with soap if they try and speak their native languages, that's genocidal. And
yeah,
so
that's beyond genocidal.
Yeah, we have a situation now where really, like, television and video games and things like that are culturally destructive forces, and we have kids not being brought up traditional. Now, certainly their choice. I wouldn't want to say, hey, I want my folks to bring me up, you know, like we did 100 years ago.
Well, certainly, but this young man loves to play Guitar Hero. But you know what I would give to know what kind of instruments are out there to be able to introduce him to? I don't even know where to get a hold of that information. I try to go to the museum, and they have some examples of some small things, but not really a whole lot of information. And, you know, it's difficult to get the information. It's difficult to share it with our kids. It needs to be more accessible.
You're right. Yeah, culture camp is one possibility.
That's very true. And also another thing is, I think when these young people get in trouble, way too often they're being shoved into the white judicial system, and they really need to be spoken to by their elders. Their elders hold a whole lot more influence over them.
Oh boy, we're all nodding our heads here. Yeah.
Will ever.
Yeah.
What?
We're all nodding our heads. Tracy, thank you. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. You guys have a good one.
Okay. Joe, I heard you trying to say something there from the Buffalo Airport.
I think that, you know, in a large part of Alaska, the cultural traditions are very strong still, and there are a lot of good examples, especially in Western Alaska, where young people have stepped up as leaders and taken on projects and responsibilities that are very inspiring. You know, people that I work with on environmental public health issues that, you know, can make the translation between at least somewhat successfully between the language of government and the programs of government and the provision of services at the local level. It's a difficult translation to make, but people have stepped up and been there. And where it's successful is where three things fall together. One is where local governance is very strong, self-governance is strong. The other piece is where there's a strong protection of cultural integrity. And the other piece is when there's an opportunity for economic development, you know. And when those three factors are in place, we see that there is a strong ability or capability within tribal communities, within indigenous populations, to make the most out of the government services that are available.
So, you know, an example that comes to my mind is Yvonne Peter up in Athabascan Country in Arctic Village, becoming the traditional chief with the nod of the elders at an astoundingly young age. You know, they just said that this guy's got what it takes and we're putting him in charge.
How old was he?
I don't know if he was even 18.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
He was very young, yeah.
And he's a significant leader now. I mean, he's really, the elders were right, and he's grown into this role. And, mm-hmm. So what are some of the barriers? Like, right now, our Attorney General, Mr. Sullivan, is heading up a new, I guess it was started under the Palin administration, but under the Parnell administration, it's really being activated and getting to work, a rural sub-cabinet. And they're going to be going out to villages. A schedule will probably be announced in another few days. And they want to know what they ought to be doing, how the administration can pay more attention, and how where are the barriers, including economic development, I think we should add. So this is probably a positive development. And if you were talking to them, Joe, if you were counseling them as to how to conduct themselves at their hearings when they're out there asking people to speak, what would you say to them? How would you tell them to listen, or maybe even to talk to the people that aren't necessarily the spokespeople?
Well, I think we make a lot of assumptions, and I think that would be the first thing that I would say. I'll never forget walking into a water plant. I was invited to a village to go look at the water and sanitation conditions, and I was so overwhelmed by the conditions that were, you know, a real immediate threat to public health, that when the water operator walked in, and I've never done this before, but I called on the full weight of my, my official government standing, and I said, Joe Sarcone, EPA. And he looked at me and he said, good for you, you know. And so,
that's the kind of thing Jack would say.
and you know, I thought it was a great response. I thought it was a great response because, you know, because we assume that when we walk into these situations, that there's a meaning, that there's some meaning for what we think is important within that culture. And so, you know, I think that we need to step back and we need to not make too many assumptions about what's meaningful for the people that we're there to serve, and let people tell us what's meaningful for their lives and what's important. You know, because every time I think about now introducing myself, I always think, good for you. You know, Joe Sarcone, CDC, good for you. So what?
I'm going to steal that one. I like that one.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, I think that's one thing. And just real quickly, another thing is, I was in Kotlik, and they were practicing for first dance, where they go over to Stebbins and do the first dance. And I sat there for two nights watching people practice, and I came away from that thinking, you know, I will never know, truly know, the way the communication and the culture and the tradition happens here, because it didn't, you know, it just, things unfolded in a way that I could never understand. And I think that's the other thing that you have to bring to it. You have to know that you don't know, and that you may never know, you know, the true essence of the culture, and you have to be okay with that, you know. So anyway, I'll leave it at that for the moment.
All right, Joe, thank you. Yeah, I would chip in this one other one that often in meetings of really any indigenous people that I know of, there's a bit of a talking circle effect that takes place where when one person's talking, everybody else is listening. And when they're done, then the next person will talk. And they will build on what was said before. And you have to learn to listen, remembering the things that have already been said. And that doesn't necessarily, you'll see that a little bit in the Western culture meetings, that people say, well, I don't need to say all this other stuff that's already been said, but what I want to add is thus and such. But it's really, I think there's a different quality of listening in the indigenous cultures when it comes to those type of meetings. At least that's been my observation. You're like, you got to wait till the end to get the real zingers. let's go to Myra, joins the program from Igigik. Oh, it's great to hear from Igigik. Hello, Myra.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this urban-rural divide. I'd just like to say I appreciate your shows when I get a chance to listen to them. You do a good job.
Thank you.
I think one thing that I see that needs to happen is a reminder that when the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was being built, the promise was to fix the urban areas first because they had most people, and then work on the rural needs. But it seems to have gone away, and now the urban areas seem to feel entitled to the majority, if not all, the money pots that become available. And the state wants to limit rural airfields to 3,000 feet, which makes flying in fuel more expensive due to the size limit of the airplanes that can land and haul fuel, which, by the way, there are very few airplanes that can do it. This and the lack of roads between communities makes the clamor for the Kinnickarm Bridge seem a discouraging waste of money for the benefit of, again, the urban folks. Maybe if there was a more equitable way to prioritize projects, it might help and stop the migration and the heavy impact on the urban services that is happening right now. I guess one of my wishes has been for altruistic urban legislators to represent the whole state instead of just the district that puts them in place. And I don't know how we'd go about building those kind of bridges that would be effective, that weren't dependent on the re-election of the people we're dealing with. But I sure would like to see it happen.
Well done. Well said. You know, you might, you know, sometimes the administration can exercise some of that leadership, because when it comes to the capital budget, they usually give the administration a chunk of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's one angle, but that's very, very nicely rendered, especially the way you worked out about bridges.
Oh, thank you.
Right.
Well, to talk to the Department of Transportation is just a heartache when they just insist on 3,000-foot airfields. It's why Igigik owns their own, because we wanted an airfield that could land planes big enough to fly fish out. And because we own it, now we're having trouble getting money pots or available to pave it so that we can really get into a good community effort to fly fish out.
Yeah.
I think that would help stop the migration if there was a better way to make a living in the rural areas.
That's a very good example, and I'm reminded of the guy with his HUD home and his 60-foot well. Thank you very much for your call there from Igigik, Myra. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about creativity crossing cultural and bureaucratic boundaries as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Communications Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
It's Talk of Alaska. It's talk@APRN.org if you want to get an email through, and we have one from Nome. One way we in rural Alaska counter the high cost of fuel and electricity is our proximity to wild game, and yet the state asserts that all residents should have equal access to fish and game. In keeping with that thinking, we should have electric and fuel cost equalization across the state, where electricity, gas, and heating fuel cost the same across the state. Well, I doubt it'll ever get to that point, but the power cost equalization did get passed and did get signed. So at least that one is on the books for a while. I've got Joe Sarcone by telephone from the airport in Bethel, where he's waiting for the weather to clear up so he can get to. Are you still there, Joe? Oh, okay, good. Joe is gone. Jack, it's just you and me now, and the callers. Jack Abraham, Alaska native artist, well-known mask carver, who now his masks will get more valuable because he's not going to make any more. You think I don't know that. And Jack asked me to do this program. He said, you know, I just think we need to start talking to people in rural Alaska about, well, you say it the way you want to say it.
Yeah, absolutely, because we're going to be left with ghost towns if this continues, because I remember even was last year when they sent out this so-called energy rebate, and I knew what was going to happen. Is people are going to use that money. They're going to buy plane tickets, move into the cities, and apply for food stamps and welfare there. And sure enough, in October, there was a story in the paper about the sudden jump in enrollment in the schools, which is a clear indicator of what's been happening. And I've met already, since I've been here back here a month, how many people have moved in just from Bethel because they couldn't afford to live just even in Bethel. And see, some people even moving all the way down to Portland. So we're having a exodus of people moving away from the rural areas because of they just simply cannot afford to live there anymore. And how are we going to stem that? And how are we going to stop that? And it's very, very difficult. I know how some people, I've met some people before already, said, I asked them if they're a registered voter, and they said, oh, they don't even want to get involved in the process. There's no one that I want to even think about voting. And I said, well, I can understand that to a certain degree, that kind of apathy and frustration, but that's not the solution. You know, you're only, you know, shutting things off for your own satisfaction. You still have to think about, you know, how is it affecting your neighbor? How is it affecting your children, your grandkids? I have three grandsons now, but they don't live here in Alaska, but it could very well be affecting them. I have a lot of old relatives who are still out in the villages, and I can't imagine how difficult it's going to be this coming winter. You know, I just hope I don't have to hear any more stories about somebody deciding between having to keep your house warm and getting something to eat. And I'm guessing, you know, a lot of these politicians have never had to make that decision. You know, that's why I say, if you really want to get an idea what it's like, move out there for a while, live there for a while, then you get maybe we'll get some things done. But I see here that, like we said, we're mired in layers and layers of bureaucracy. You know, even myself, I get tempted and still now just to walk away and say, I can't handle this, this is too much. I wake up, I go to sleep with a headache sometimes. But
I wake up, I've been dreaming about it.
Yeah, so, but I, at the part of me also, too, is just, you know, can't keep it mouth shut and I have to go do something about it while I still can. And I think if more people would take that particular kind of attitude where they say, yes, it's hard, it's difficult, going in knowing that it's hard. And I heard where someone said, I heard someone, well, if it's impossible, I guess it's just going to take a little bit longer to do.
Well, I think sometimes the policy sector lags the people. For instance, last year, along with, you know, giving out an extra permanent fund dividend, the state also put a whole bunch more money into weatherization, and the rush was enormous. So, you know, it's really a small statement to say, I'm going to make my nest to where I don't have as big a carbon footprint. But, you know, if enough people just say that little bit, that's a huge statement.
Yeah, I'm, matter of fact, I think myself, what I think I might do is on my own, I apparently have a house that I can use in Hooper Bay as an experiment. Maybe I have an idea where to, for instance, myself, to build sort of a plexiglass enclosure on the south side of a home that, and paint it black on the inside so that it captures the heat when the sun does come out. And it got to make some difference because the concept is there. It works. So I encourage people out there to, you know, be creative, think of something, to find a way to help yourself, because you're going to be waiting for a long time for Washington, D.C. to come and step in.
Okay, Delise, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. I don't know if everyone's familiar with Alaska Intertribal Council. We have a website, www.aitc.org. The tribes of Alaska formed this nonprofit, you know, to access grants, basically to help us build infrastructure in our tribal communities.
Yeah, I remember. I remember when it was done, there were other organizations that tried, and this is the one that finally stuck. I remember United Tribes of Alaska.
Yes, yeah. I do too. And, you know, so despite many false starts and stumbles, you know, we're now 17 years old. And AITC has been invited by FEMA to be on the weekly teleconference calls addressing the flood victims on the Yukon and Kuskokwim River.
Oh, thank you. So we can close the show with a little bit of encouraging news.
Yes, yes. We've been on the calls. I know that I too felt like, come on, let's hurry up. Let's invite everybody, you know, just not the faith-based initiative people to be responding. I wanted to open it up to all the volunteers so that people could, you know, outline their summer vacations. Or
yeah,
we do have people with all kinds of skills, building skills.
Oh, yeah. I was talking to somebody yesterday from the Cusco. He says, geez, I feel like I ought to be, shouldn't we be shipping our fish to the Yukon? And as a matter of fact, that happened last year. Probably is happening this year.
Yes.
I want to thank you so much for your call. We're just about out of time. And you did want to note that there are still a whole bunch of open cases from the flooding, right?
Yes. From last year's flooding, we're still dealing with 60 open cases from last year's flooding. So, you know, it takes a while to build capacity and to address all these homes that have been impacted. And I want to thank everybody across the state who can maybe call us, or that would probably be the best, or write us an email. You can get onto our website, and maybe we can get some more of those volunteers into the needed areas.
All right. Well, thank you. That's great. AITC has at least got something going with volunteerism. Jack Abraham, I want to thank you so much for coming in, for having the motivation to call and get this ball rolling. Who knows where it'll go?
Well, thank you for having me here. It's a great pleasure. I wanted to get a message out to all the friends and relatives out in Alaska. Please get involved. Educate yourself about the issues and get after it.
All right. Thank you, Jack Abraham. Thank you, Joe Sarcone. Gooseberry Peter on the controls. Len Anderson on the phones. Pat Yak producing. I'm Steve Heimel. I want to thank you very much for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.